So welcome everyone. This is Joan Costafont, professor of health economics at the London School of Economics, and I welcome you to this event held by LSE Ideas in partnership with the Central and Southern Eastern Program and the Ratio Forum, a joint initiative by the Ratio Family, Charitable Foundation, and the Ratio Democracy Center, and of course, as I mentioned, LSE Ideas. This event is part of a broader LSE agenda shaping the COVID world. And particularly today, we will focus on vaccination hesitancy, which is one of the probably top policy questions in the context of the sort of final wave of COVID-19. The questions that we plan to address today are around what is driving vaccination uptake gaps between Western and Eastern Europe, and particularly what can be done to address these challenges. We know that vaccination hesitancy was already like a prominent challenge that the WHO and other organizations were facing before COVID-19, but the pandemic has actually exacerbated the importance of dealing with vaccination hesitancy. We know that vaccination hesitancy has a lot to do with concerns around efficacy, safety, and side effects of vaccines. But recently, some research, including research of my own, has shown the importance of levels of trust, trust in doctors, trust in scientists, in the industry, and in the NHS as driving vaccination hesitancy, and particularly vaccination hesitancy amongst minorities. For instance, in Britain, it would be typically people from Caribbean origins, as well as Pakistani, Bangladeshi, and so forth. And of course, in other parts of the world, like the US, would be other ethnic groups. And we know that part of this vaccination hesitancy has a lot to do with other political discrimination or past discrimination, previous negative experiences. In Eastern Europe, experiences of forced vaccination have been very much prominent. And of course, there is always like some level of optimism on the side of individuals driving those attitudes. So to speak about this, we have three speakers today. We'll begin with Pauline Patterson, who's the director of the Vaccine Confidence Project at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. And she's an expert on vaccination confidence. She's been researching issues on confidence towards immunization since 2010. And she's a member of the National Institute of Health Research, Health Protection Research Unit, Immunization in Partnership with Public Health England. Our second speaker is Dr. Juliana Mer, senior lecturer in psychology at the Institute of Psychiatry, Psychology and Neuroscience at King's College London. She's also a consultant, a clinical psychologist at South London and monthly NHS Foundation Trust. And she has a growing interest in health inequalities and particularly inequalities that have to do with racial and ethnic minority groups. And finally, we have Mr. Paul Smith, who's been the General Secretary of the Austrian Society of European Politics since 2009. He previously has worked, and hopefully I pronounce this well, with the Richte National Bank, both in Vienna and the representative office in Brussels, the permanent representation of Austria in the European Union. And his current work focuses on the analysis and the discussion of political issues regarding European integration, and today we'll hear particularly his views on vaccination. In order to organize this debate, what we will do is we will start with a first round of contributions, then we'll follow up with another round, and then we'll start picking up questions from you. Ideally, speakers should speak for no more than 9 minutes, and then after the second round, we'll pick up questions from the Q&A. So we look forward to hear from your views. And then we'll finish off the session with some final contributions. So we'll start as expected with Pauline Patterson. Welcome, over to you.
Great, thank you so much. Just share the slides. So I thought I'd start by saying, what is vaccine hesitancy, so that everyone's on the same page in terms of defining it. So the WHO SAGE Working Group on Vaccine Hesitancy defines it as a delay in acceptance or refusal of vaccines, despite availability of vaccination services. Research has shown that it's complex and very context specific. So it varies across time, across place. So when we do look globally at different countries, you can look at country level, but really you want to be looking at subpopulation level, regional level, different groups of people. And also vaccine hesitancy depends on the vaccine. So some people might vaccinate their children, for example, against childhood vaccination, but then have hesitancy towards a flu vaccine, for example. And vaccine hesitancy includes factors such as complacency, convenience, and confidence. So complacency is a lack of perceived need. So maybe someone not thinking that it's that important to vaccinate. Convenience could be in terms of a lack of access. So the vaccination clinic could be far away, or it could be a costly vaccine, or maybe someone has to wait on the phone for 20 minutes to book an appointment. So it's difficult to get an appointment at a time that's convenient. And confidence in terms of trust, confidence, not just in the vaccine, but also in the provider or the process. So then I thought we'd focus on COVID vaccines. And this is a research study that's done in multiple countries. So it's more accurate to compare the findings from the different countries. So here you can see that the vaccine hesitancy around COVID vaccine, that there is variance in acceptance. And as I was saying before, you can look at country, but also you need to do a deeper dive as well. Like if you do notice that there's low vaccine acceptance, then you can go in and do some more kind of research, interviews and so on to figure out why that is. At the Health Protection Research Unit in Immunization, we conducted a research at the beginning of the pandemic in the first lockdown. We asked parents and caregivers. We saw there was a dip in childhood vaccination, so we wanted to see what their experiences were of vaccinating their children. And then while we were surveying them, we also thought we'd ask them about acceptance around vaccines. So when we asked if a new coronavirus vaccine became available, would you accept it? 90% responded yes. So most people do want to vaccinate, but there are the few that don't want to vaccinate. And what we saw were the main concerns for not accepting the vaccine were concerns around safety, it being a new vaccine. Initially, it was a very new vaccine. Now, many more people have been vaccinated. The process of developing the vaccine appeared to be rushed from people's perspectives, or they thought there's not enough evidence, there's not enough research. Concerns around a lack of effectiveness, as in, like, does the vaccine work? But also maybe some people, they didn't want a vaccine or didn't think they needed the vaccine because they weren't in an at-risk group. So it's not that they were worried about the vaccine. It's just that they wanted to leave the vaccine for other people that needed it more. And some other key findings we found were that the Black, Asian, Chinese, mixed and other ethnic respondents were 3 times more likely to reject the vaccine for themselves. And also lower income households were more likely to reject a COVID vaccine. More recently, we conducted a survey and interviews with health and social care workers. And here we focused on ethnic minority groups because there was evidence that in health and social care workers that they were being less vaccinated, they were accepting the vaccine less, and also they were at high risk of severe disease. So we conducted a survey and these interviews. And what we found was that health and social care workers who felt under pressure from their employer to get a vaccine were actually less likely to want to vaccinate. And also Black African and mixed Black African participants were more likely not to be offered the vaccine, to not have it available for them, and more likely to have declined the COVID vaccine. And we also found that social care workers were more likely to not be offered the vaccine, like the systems weren't as in place, like healthcare workers were more likely to be working in a hospital where the systems were in place to go get vaccinated. It was easy. Whereas social care workers that, for example, is looking after one person in their house. The systems weren't in place for them to go get vaccinated. Some of them even had to then register with the hospital nearby or that sort of thing. But the main reasons for declining were concerns around side effects, a lack of research, not feeling at risk of severe COVID, but also we saw distrust in the government, in pharmaceutical companies, manufacturers, and the media. I then thought that I better show you this framework because it helps think from an individual perspective of how do people make this decision? Shall I vaccinate? Shall I not? And although the majority of people in the UK with childhood vaccination, for example, would just vaccinate without really thinking about it, it would just be like a natural thing. Some people do think a bit more about, shall I vaccinate, shall I not, looking at all these different factors. So here, as you can see, there's information such as campaigns, education, recommendations, media, and then information is processed into individual risk perceptions. So risk of infection and risk of a vaccine adverse event. And then there are these modifying factors. So attitudes, identity, injunctive norms. What should I do? Should I vaccinate myself, my child, so on? Descriptive norms. What do others do? If your friends and family vaccinate, you're more likely to vaccinate. Habit. So if you vaccinated in the past, you're more likely to vaccinate in the future. And then these barriers that I mentioned about the convenience side of it. Is it expensive? Does it take a lot of time to do? Is there a big effort? And then people might want to vaccinate, they intend to vaccinate, but then there's that extra jump of actually going and getting vaccinated. And with this pandemic and with all pandemics comes a load of information and a load of misinformation. And the COVID pandemic is no exception. And Dr. Tedros Adhanom, the Director General of WHO, warned against an infodemic of rumors and misinformation that needs to be fought alongside this pandemic. And we have seen this. With the internet and social media, there is so much information. You can pretty much go onto the internet and find anything that agrees with whatever you're thinking. So people tend to search for information that reinforces their pre-existing views. And also you can group. So you can group with people that you might not have been able to group with before that have the same beliefs, same views as you. But people are more empowered as well. It's not all bad as well. There's some good information out there and it's a great way to connect as well. But concerns can spread quickly and they can spread far. And we did a study at LSHTM where we looked at the impact of misinformation around COVID vaccine. And we found this was in the US and the UK, and we're going to run it again in five more countries this year. But we did find in that study that exposure to misinformation around COVID vaccines does reduce people's intent on vaccinating against COVID. So that's worth considering. And I just wanted to finish to that for a successful immunization program, you need a family, a patient, a public, who's aware of the vaccine, perceives a need to vaccinate, trusts the vaccine provider and policy. But you don't just need that. You also need a healthcare worker who's trained, supported and satisfied, and an immunization system which makes available safe and effective vaccines in a timely and equitable manner. Thank you.
So much, that's great. I will come back to some of these points. So perhaps now, Juliana, you wanna chip in? Yeah, over to you, Juliana.
Thank you.
Great.
Can you see it?
Yeah, yeah.
Perfect. Okay, welcome everybody. So my name's Juliana and I'm talking as part of the Tackling Inequalities and Discrimination Experiences in Health Services research. And this is a project that's led by Stephanie Hatch over at King's College, along with lots of other collaborators, including NHS England and the Royal College of Nursing. But fundamentally, the project is focused on trying to aim to understand the sort of discrimination that might be witnessed or experienced by healthcare practitioners and how that kind of relates to their own work and health outcomes. And some of you might be sitting on this webinar thinking, well, that's interesting. How does that relate to the purpose of today in terms of our vaccines? Well, We know in terms of the earlier part of the work that high levels of discrimination is certainly witnessed and experienced by patients and healthcare workers in the NHS. And actually it's this experience that can go on to generate more or certainly perpetuate further inequalities as regards in terms of our own health service use. So I just want you to have that in mind, that against this backdrop, against this sort of, you know, setting of discrimination and exposure, particularly when we think about healthcare staff, that I'm going to focus on issues around vaccines. And so again, as part of this earlier work, we know that there are particular groups that are disproportionately reporting, anyone shouldn't report it, but really elevated levels around discrimination and harassment in healthcare. And that's particularly those that are women, those from Black, racial and ethnic minority groups, those that are migrant groups. And we know that this discrimination in itself maps on to poorer health outcomes, particularly in relation to physical and mental health outcomes. But equally for groups feeling less satisfied in their work and also sort of long periods of sickness and, you know, poor work productivity. So part of this work in terms of the initial work was very much spent around interviewing healthcare practitioners from different trusts across London and kind of really mapping their experience around harassment, discrimination, particularly as it related to the workplace. And what was interesting again was that these incidents and these reports of discrimination where people felt that and were reporting that were often attributed to race or ethnicity. So we know that another kind of factors that fed into this were issues around unfair disciplinaries, negative work appraisals. So as you can see here, that I'm describing an environment where for staff who are charged with caring for other people, are also talking about working in an environment where they are being exposed to unfair practices and discrimination. So we wanted to kind of take this further. So, you know, the pandemic came along almost 2 years ago. And in conjunction with the NHS Check survey, we wanted to look about how those sort of ethnic inequalities and those difficulties that people were reporting, how they were being affected by COVID-19. So as part of this work, there's a much more sort of quantitative based survey, but we also had a qualitative survey, a qualitative investigation of people's experiences, and particularly as it related to the COVID vaccine. And what we found, we interviewed 25 healthcare practitioners, and these were some of those people that took part in our first wave of the study, but also a boosted sample. And what was very interesting in terms of the times that we were doing this, this was interviews from up until early part of last year, was that the decision, if you think about what's Pauline's just said, but the decision to actually take up or to embark upon a COVID-19 vaccine involves a considerable balance between people thinking about what would be the implications and issues and needs of protecting themselves, but also of their family members and the groups that they're part of. But also that was pitted against concerns and fears of harm, particularly around the mistrust in the vaccine, particularly as it related to how it was developed, you know, and also people's own vulnerability to the impact of the vaccine. For some, there were lots around moral objections, you know, in terms of ethical objections. And this was particularly just think around the time when lots of concerns, particularly in social media, about the sort of ingredients or the components of the vaccine. But most importantly for us as well was concerns for staff about institutional or workplace pressure and how that also linked to sort of information and misinformation. Another important component, actually, you know, because across the board, this was a sample of mixed ethnicities, mixed races. But what we did find in those groups that were particularly from racial and ethnic minority groups, that their decision around embarking upon a vaccine and concerns and fears not to have a vaccine were very much entwined with broader concerns around institutional and structural discrimination. And this particularly related to issues such as, you know, historical racial injustices around vaccine development and testing, and very much linked to poor practices around research and organisations and how they work towards or treat those from minoritised and particularly racially minoritised backgrounds. Real concerns very much around the legitimacy, the authenticity, the trustworthiness of the messaging around vaccines. And also, actually, for many, there was a real concern. And bear this in mind, when we were doing this research, this was prior to some of our recent developments, but a real concern and a suspicion that they would be mandated to take the vaccine at that time. And this was at the start of last year. So particular examples, I'm not going to read through them all, but and also we'll send a link to the paper, but just examples of some of those areas that were coming up as we look at the racial injustices. You know, someone had said, you know, because we've been, you know, historically, politically used as guinea pigs for all sorts of things and harmed historically, and particularly people kind of brought online very quickly information around what's happened in the US and here and whatever, you know, as a group, people, BME people. So, you know, I understand hesitancy in terms of not being able to trust the government, not being able to trust sometimes the science. Or just, you know, as an example of the religious or ethical concerns, someone put, you know, a lot of people kind of, you know, religious reasons for not taking it, because there was something in the news today about some of the components of the vaccine, you know, genes from kind of unborn babies or something crazy like that. So a lot of religious people will not take the vaccines for these sorts of reasons. And then just sort of darting back, and the final comment, just to kind of leave just around the suspicion and fear. You know, because at the time, you know, people saying from BME backgrounds, I've been identified as having higher risk. They could potentially also be more pressured into getting it, in getting the vaccine, and the concerns about it being mandatory. And that, you know, again, just look at the informant, that was from a white British person themselves. Just as I said, it's an open access paper. It's definitely, conflict of interest, I was going to say, it's definitely worth reading, of course it is, but very much to kind of bring to bear some of those, I guess, the very subtle, very nuanced, the very complex sort of decision making that people were making around the vaccine, and how their ideas about that were not divorced from broader issues that were going on in society at that time. So I will end it there. Hopefully that was just within the minute.
That's brilliant. Thank you so much. So then our third speaker, Paul, could perhaps take over.
Well, it would be my pleasure. Thank you very much for the invitation. My name is Paul Schmidt. I'm connected with you from Austria, from Vienna. And well, I think I can connect very well to what Pauline and Juliana just said, and add my thoughts maybe on the communication side, which influences very much the openness towards vaccines or the hesitancy. Now, I think many points were made that I can relate to, actually. It is interesting to see that there are points which countries have in common, and then there are elements where if you look at different countries, you have different experience, different approaches. It has to do with tradition, history, culture, geography. So there are many elements that feed into this. Pauline, for example, had a graph where she had a list of countries included. I was looking actually at Russia. And then I thought about what Pauline said about disinformation. It's interesting. Russia is an interesting case in point, because Russia there's a high level of vaccine hesitancy in Russia. And at the same time, Russia tried to produce its own vaccine and tried to export its vaccine and use this vaccine as a political tool. There was a lot of disinformation there included. The vaccine was used as a diplomatic tool, and many, I think this is a good case if you want to look at disinformation. Now, if you look at the European continent, you will find many, many differences between the different approaches. Let me give you some data on this or some ideas of what the different countries did. If you look at, for example, at the vaccination rates of this February, you will find big, big differences, for example, between Portugal and Spain with very high levels of vaccinations, high vaccination rates. But if you look, for example, at Bosnia-Herzegovina or at the EU country Bulgaria, you will have vaccination rates which are still around 30% or lower. Now, then if you look at the country which I know best, for example, Austria, we are somehow in the European average with around 70% of vaccinations at this moment. Now, you have very different experiences, of course. I mean, if Austrians talk about a lockdown, my Spanish family would be told about what we understand and how we define a lockdown, they would be laughing at us, because a lockdown in Austria meant something very different to what my nephews in Spain experienced, where they had to stay almost 2 months locked up in their home, while when we talked about a lockdown in Austria, we could still go to work, we could still take a walk, we could go to the supermarket. And not much really changed for us, okay, apart from trying to keep the distance. Now, if you look at the different measures that were taken, they're also they also have an impact, of course, on the vaccination rates. Look at Sweden or Switzerland, for example, with a very liberal approach. They never locked down their restaurants or bars or pubs. They never closed the firms or companies and enterprises compare the death tolls. And you will see that the picture is not that, that the track records are not that different. I think one of the reasons, but Joanne, of course, knows that probably better than I do, one of the reasons why the vaccination rates are so high in Spain and Portugal is, of course, the tough lockdown they had is, of course, the trust in science, but the lack of trust in healthcare, at least in Spain. My Spanish stepfather, for example, he didn't really have he wasn't really eager to go to hospital, because he knows that the treatment that he expects is not a very good one. So you rather get vaccinated, apart from the fact that the cultural element comes in, where hierarchy is different, and the way data is treated and the way people are informed by their mobile phones that they have an appointment for the vaccination is quite different to a very much more liberal approach in Austria and Germany, where we say, well, let's leave it up to the people if they want to get vaccinated or not. And the result in Austria and Germany was that the rate of people vaccinated was quite low. Now, Austria is an interesting case also because we have just introduced obligatory vaccination at the beginning of March. If you don't get vaccinated, you will get fined. But the question is, how will it be executed? So we're not really sure about that. And then you have different phases of the corona, where the different mutations and variants of corona were met by different kinds of communication. For example, if you politicize the communication, it's short-sighted, and it becomes more emotional, it becomes less scientific, I think from our experience, it is fair to say that it is not an advantage if you politicize communication on the measures that you are going to take. If you have free testing, free PCR testing, as you have in Austria, I can get tested 4 to 5 times or more. I can get tested every day. How does this influence the way the society reacts to vaccines? So that's another question which you have to take into account. Some people, he would argue that it doesn't help to raise the vaccination rate if the testing is free of charge. We also have another particularity. We have one right-wing established political party who actually campaigned against vaccines and made it even more a political issue. So that made things even more difficult. Now, in other countries, you have different approaches to this. I mean, we had a special particular lockdown for the unvaccinated part of the society. So they were actually discriminated. Now, it also has to do with access to communication and media outlets. It's interesting to see, for example, in Austria, that the big Turkish community has a higher vaccination rate than you would find in some Austrian rural areas where the rate is high of those people who elect the far right party that is against obligatory vaccination. Why is that? That is because many Turks also consume Turkish media. And the vaccination issue was a big issue in the Turkish media, and they trust the Turkish news on this issue, and that is why their vaccination rate is higher than in some of the Austrian areas. And there's what we also find that in some countries you have quite a substantial rural-urban divide. For example, in the city of Vienna, testing is easier. It is, in particular, in the cities, more difficult to move around without vaccines. It is easier to get the virus. In fact, it is easier to be socially discriminated. It is access to free testing is easier. Maybe you have more liberal stances in the cities, however you define them, but there's quite a gap between the rural and the urban places. I would argue that's what we see from our data. Now, there's a lot of takeaways from this, but I would like to leave it there, and I look forward to this very, very interesting discussion, and just want to say that the whole disinformation question is something which you probably find in every country to a certain extent, and which would probably need a debate on its own because it has such an importance.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, all three of you. It was a great introduction. Let me just pick up on some of the points that you've raised and perhaps try to play a little devil advocate here. So starting with Paulina, I was wondering, and perhaps that's something that probably it will relate to all of you, the role of regulation. So part of the vaccine hesitancy might well be the result of regulation failures or regulation misalignment. I'm thinking here about decisions that of certain European countries or the European Union with regards to AstraZeneca, for instance, that might have created additional distrust. Perhaps here, other questions around the fact that some minorities, so when we discussed about vaccine hesitancy, this is something that affects particularly some minorities, might have been more likely to suffer themselves COVID. So they might have gone through COVID. So if they might think that they are protected because they had COVID, so that could explain as well the higher levels of vaccination hesitancy there. We've heard about risk perceptions as being one of the true sort of drivers of vaccination intentions. And here particularly there is the question, for instance, it was referred, I think Paul referred to Spain. I mean, countries that experienced the pandemic earlier, like Spain and Italy, might be more frightened about COVID-19. So that's why they probably are taking up the vaccine at a higher rate than perhaps other countries that experience it later. So I wonder whether you have anything to say about that. Then Juliana's point on minorities, I was wondering here whether the fact that some of the tests might not have included minorities, that might have actually steered this sort of perception that perhaps vaccines were not totally safe. And I thought that perhaps all of you could perhaps say a bit more about mandates as bringing what behavioral economists call crowding out. No, I mean, people are reacting against mandates, against being treated as guinea pigs. They seem to find vaccination as a cheap way to take back on the government, which perhaps they didn't have other means to do that. I can only think of one other movement that would compare to the anti-vaxxers, which would be the anti-psychiatry movement back 20 or 30 years ago in some European countries. And then another important point that I've heard from Paul as well was the connection between vaccination hesitancy and populism, particularly in the case of Spain, but I know that in other parts of Europe as well, there's a close link between, you know, being anti-vaxxer and supporting populist movements. That means that vaccination has been politicized. And of course, that's something that perhaps would be driving vaccination intention. So let's just pick up another round of comments, starting with Pauline.
Great, thank you. Some great points. I hope I remember all of them. But I mean, it's such an interesting topic, isn't it? But if we could start with the AstraZeneca, so vaccine scares, whether real or not, have been shown to derail immunization programs. There was a vaccine scare to do with dengue vaccine in the Philippines, and actually confidence dipped in the dengue vaccine, but also in childhood vaccines, and even in other public health treatments. So it's something to be aware of with new vaccines, that any vaccine scares to do with the new vaccine can affect routine immunization. So it's worth being aware of, real or not, just perceived. But in terms of, I think I agree with what Paul was saying in terms of policies and these different lockdowns. I mean, it's incredible, isn't it, how the different perceptions of lockdown and how governments have chosen to deal with the pandemic and what forces they've used or not. So, and we have seen, so we do some media monitoring at LSHTM in our team, and we have seen that when there have been more severe lockdowns or kind of restrictions not based on evidence or conflicting information, then that has created anger, unhappiness, kind of discontent in terms of media conversations. I mean, obviously, like, if you think that the government are making a bad decision about something not based on evidence, it's going to annoy you, isn't it? And it affects everyone, like no other disease has affected us before, like these lockdowns and also the fear mongering. But something we haven't talked about at all is some people aren't vaccinating because they're not in at-risk groups. I mean, I mentioned it a little bit, but really, like, the majority of people who aren't vaccinating are because they're young. They or that they've seen that the vaccine doesn't provide protection for very long, or maybe they've had the first dose but not the second dose and not the booster, or maybe they've had two doses. So there's a lot to consider there. And also, it's really key not to stigmatize people and not to blame them as well, because I really think that in terms of if people aren't vaccinating, we really need to know why. Because also initially it was really difficult. And if you don't have an NHS number, if you're not registered with a GP, then it's more complicated, it's more difficult. So we really need to sort that out. And actually, a really, really key point in terms of looking at vaccine uptake across the globe is there are a lot of places that don't have enough vaccine and don't have enough access. And we really need to focus on that. Rather than worrying in some of our countries that we haven't reached that last 10% for that third dose or the fourth dose, you know, let's get everyone across the globe vaccinated with two doses who need it. Let's get the vaccine to people who need it, who are in at-risk groups, or healthcare workers who are on the front line treating at-risk groups. I'll stop there and let others talk, but I've got other comments about mandatory vaccination, but potentially that's for another round of discussions.
Great, thanks so much. So, Juliana, your turn.
Thank you, Joan. And I just was totally in agreement with what Pauline was saying. So it's for me, echoing that. I think just something, I'm doing that terrible thing that's probably not answering any of your questions that you just brought up, because I can't remember them all, but so I'll just say what I needed to say. But I think there's an important issue around the politicisation of vaccine hesitancy, even the name. You know, most people didn't know this, didn't even know that there was a hesitancy prior to March. And if you kind of look at the good work of our public health colleagues who were dealing with this sort of this type of issues quite successfully, actually, for different groups. And I think, but the focus for me, particularly on those marginalised groups, where around that time, there was just a greater spotlight for a variety of reasons, you know, literally because of your colour, you were at risk, and therefore you're at risk, and therefore you should be very grateful that you're doing this and taking this. And why the hell are you not doing this? You know, because that's a terrible thing. And you're not, you know, you're not being a good part of the team. And so in terms of going back to what Pauline had mentioned, and indeed Paul as well, is about trying to understand the nuance behind that. And that, you know, for the work that we're focused on here from Tides, it was really clear that it wasn't a simple decision. It just wasn't a simple decision. And that in many ways is can be a cause and effect of all the other issues. That me deciding to take something, or indeed declining that, wasn't me just being stupid, wasn't me not caring, wasn't me not wanting to be part of the team. I was having to really weigh this up, because maybe I'm the only earner in the household. What if something went wrong with this vaccine with me? What would that mean for my dependents, let alone my work? At the same time, for some, not all, people having access to, you know, their WhatsApp messaging. And I knew it certainly, even when I saw some stuff that came through my own family, it was like, what? I mean, if you did believe that, then it would totally make sense that you wouldn't, you know, you'd be running the other way. And then actually, when you began to speak to people, which is really important, if you kind of think over the last couple of years, we've become even more refined. And even your public health colleagues would say they've become even more refined about how they try to address issues around hesitancy, because we know that it's not the same for all groups, that other factors will disproportionately affect that. And, you know, we can't divorce this. Certainly for the for many marginalized groups, in terms of what was happening nationally and internationally. And so, you know, bad things happen to people that look like me and you. So why would I think any differently now? And unfortunately, this isn't a political thing, but unfortunately, the more we get the sort of drip feed of news that, you know, highlights what practices might have been going on in different areas at a time when people felt like they were making considerable sacrifices, that has only served to confirm many people's beliefs about, actually, that was the good thing. I'm glad I didn't do that. And so that's why you can't look at this in a vacuum. And we can't, even for minoritized groups, and particularly racially minoritized groups, being very careful, I would argue, about trying to use the same brush with all groups, because there are different factors that are stress points for particular groups. And the very last thing I just want to say, sorry for taking up the time, was what often felt like a focus, rightfully, on racially minoritized groups meant that other groups, if you listen to what Paul was saying, other groups were missing. So if you happen to be, you know, a nationalist group, or you happen to be a group that, you know, you were working and you had lots of money, but you actually didn't think very much about it, you weren't focused on. So you were okay. But the groups that were most disproportionately affected by COVID were also the groups that tended to be focused on a lot more around the narrative, around hesitancy. I'll stop.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. So perhaps Paul could follow.
I try. What can I add? Now, I would say, I mean, with hindsight, I think it's all much clearer and easier, maybe. But maybe there's some takeaways or lessons to be learned, I think, on how to overcome this issue of persistency. I mean, what we experienced at the beginning of the COVID wave was this race and competition between countries, I think, which was very harmful, because it is understandable, but it politicized very much the whole issue, who would be first and who would have the best production of and the fastest production of vaccines. And I think there the European Union was quite successful in the sense that it actually also, and I would like to reiterate the point that Pauline made, it actually also engaged in exporting vaccines. And I think that is crucial. I mean, we have a joint procurement that worked very successfully. We have probably too many vaccines because which we cannot use, even all of them. So let's export them as quickly as possible. But exporting them is not enough. You have to also support the administration of those vaccines, because so many vaccines which were exported could not be used because there was a lack of medical material and a lack of communication and of getting the message out to people that there was actually these vaccines available. So exporting vaccines is important, but also, of course, the autonomy of being able to produce your own vaccines. But then maybe give more time and try to build more trust for science. I think science is key in the communication, but also what Pauline said, that you have to know the reasons why people reject vaccines, because they are very, very different depending which group you talk to. And Juliana also said that. And you don't talk the same way with group X or Y. And I think one point which is important here is proximity of communication. I think if you want to reach communities, small local communities where the vaccination rate is very low and there's a lot of resistance, you have to get the mayors, you have to get the local faces to convince people to talk face to face with the people, because they have the highest rates of credibility usually, which has to do with many times, which has to do with proximity. But they don't have to be politicians all the time. Get other people, which are public figures or which have a higher level of credibility, to get the message across. I think that's another point which I would love to make. And I think it pays off to be on the safe side. We have this competition here in Austria, for example, between the city of Vienna and the national government. On the one hand, the national government, which wants to open up quickly because it has, of course, the economic interest behind it and the importance of the tourism sector behind it. On the other hand, the city of Vienna, who says, well, you better be careful, and I stick with what the scientific advice is actually. So you have to strike the right balance. But in this political communication, there always have to be a scapegoat. No, we know that it's usually the European Union. If you don't have the European Union, well, it's the capital or the national government. And you somehow have to get across those scapegoat issue. And when we talk about health, it gets much more serious. And I would like to stress once again, I think we have to give the scientific world much more limelight and much more have to pay much more attention to them. My last point is that it's interesting that when we have football championships, there seem to be millions of football trainers among us. No, and when we have a foreign affairs crisis, we all of a sudden seem to be experts in Russian politics, and we have a health crisis, we all seem to be experts in COVID and virology. I think we somehow have to strike the right balance there and regain the trust in science, and give more, pay more attention, and give more limelight, give more stage to those people who actually know. I think that's really important.
So much. So we have actually already like seven questions, and I have as well some comments from your recent contributions. One on first contribution on the role of identity and communities in incentivizing vaccines, and I think this is quite important. But one of the risks is that it can go both ways. So if let's say being a liberal means taking on the vaccine, then those that oppose liberal values might just take the vaccine, not taking the vaccine as their identity, right? So I wonder whether you have anything to say about this. Then another interesting note is that, for instance, countries that in the past used to be quite vaccine hesitant, or even, you know, pretty high up on anti-vaxxer movements, like France, for instance, now, in the context of COVID-19, they seem to show reasonably high levels of vaccination. So it seems that maybe this pandemic has helped some countries to abandon their anti-vaxxer movements or become less vaccine hesitant. So in that respect, maybe the COVID vaccine has helped other vaccines. So there might be spillover effects on other vaccines. And then, so besides these two points, there's a number of points from the audience. I'll just pick up three of them in the first round, and then we'll pick up three more later on. So Ibrahim Zafar is actually asking about how to deal with the rural-urban divide, whether there is a role for faith, for instance, leaders or community leaders to close down that divide. And another point to do with the fact that, you know, we've mentioned that trust is so important. So how do we create trust in communities? Are there any examples of trust building initiatives in formerly distrustful communities? I mean, is there anything we can do there? And then another question around platforms, what's their role in combating misinformation? So let's stop there and then pick up the rest of the questions in the next round. Perhaps Pauline could go next.
Great, thank you. Thank you so much for these questions. They're great questions. And I do feel like my presentation was more focused on the kind of concerns and not on the solutions. So it's good to get to solutions now, not come out with just a load of concerns and what do you do about it. So in terms of the rural local communities, I think it's really key. Yeah, engaging faith leaders, community leaders is a good idea, but you first of all, you need to kind of figure out what are the reasons, because if the reasons are that they don't have access to the vaccine, maybe, you know, you need to address those reasons, or if there are concerns, you need to address those reasons. So you really, or if they don't feel at risk, then the faith leader going, oh, you must vaccinate, it's not going to make them want to vaccinate, is it? So it really is kind of, it's that question of trust as well, and not just convincing people to vaccinate, but actually addressing the concerns that people have and yeah, finding those solutions. In terms of trust building, so trust takes a long time to build and a moment to break. And so if trust has been broken, it's a lot of effort to get back up there. And you have to figure out why that trust has been broken. And if it is the awful medical research has happened in ethnic minorities in the past, that's a big one that we do need to focus on building. And we really, it's not an easy thing to fix, but I think it needs to be done, no? But in terms of working with communities can help, working with faith leaders, with community leaders, trying to figure out, but ways to build trust are transparency, communication, policy based on evidence, and not stigmatizing and not telling people that they're not vaccinating because they're uneducated and they don't know what they're thinking about, but actually having a conversation, having engagement, listening. It's not just about communicating out. It's talking, listening, figuring out solutions together. And in terms of technology, there's been a range of solutions, so and collaborative efforts with between platforms and public health agencies. And generally, like, there are certain points. So detecting misinformation, disinformation. But here, I want to be really clear that just because someone's questioning or something might be considered misinformation now, but it's not later. So I'm very much a detect disinformation or like serious misinformation, not something that your government just thinks is misinformation or is not happy with someone questioning the vaccine. So yeah, detect disinformation, real misinformation, reduce, remove, counter the misinformation, but also signpost towards reliable resources. And the other way is you can give the public a vaccine in fake news. So Facebook did this where you can, if you pre-warn people or give them examples of what fake news might look like, then they might be more savvy to not fall for fake news again. You know, like I even fell for like a fake text message that told me, oh, you get tax back. But and in the fake news, there's usually spelling errors on purpose, because if someone hasn't noticed it, they're the one that they're going to try and poach. Anyway, that's for another topic. But so you can vaccinate people against fake news and make them more aware of it and think, okay, what source is this from? Why are they giving me this information? Who's funding them? Looking a bit more about that. But I'll stop there. Thank you.
Brilliant. Thanks so much. Juliana, anything to add?
Yes, in terms of just the focus on trust, I think it's important just to think that this is trust at often a governmental and organisational level. But actually, if we're taking a much more public health approach, which is very, very community focused, and it's very intelligence led. So it's about at a local level, that's quite important. And I think it's just maybe just not throwing the baby out with the bathwater and actually strengthening and empowering our public health colleagues to continue doing the work. They were doing this work way before people got excited by COVID, and they will continue to do this work. I think it's really important for me, particularly talking about minoritized and certainly racially minoritized groups as well, that it tends to kind of end the conversation. Bugbear of mine that we just engage the faith groups, it'll all be done. You know, if you just get the local spiritual leader on, you'll be fine. Yeah, no. And actually, what we found, you know, if we just take the UK experience, many of our religious colleagues, not just in terms of Christian, Judaism, Islamic, have been very generous and opened up their actual places of worship. So there's no shortage of that. But just to be clear that not everybody who comes from a racially or ethnic minoritized groups is in contact with a faith leader, you know, it's about kind of going where people are. It's Pauline mentioned something which I think is really good, but it's really hard, but we cannot divorce it from that situation. when I'm exposed in 24 hour real time to inequities, when I'm on the receiving end of inequalities, when things that might seem historical to people but are just real, that is not separate from somebody talking to me in my primary care setting, asking me about, you know, whether I should do these things. So actually researchers who are engaged in all manner of research, not just around COVID or vaccines, we all have a responsibility, because every bad practice that happens has implications for our own generations and those that go forth. So yes, it might feel like it's a, you know, a massive piece of work to do, but it's our responsibility. And the final bit is, you know, Paul mentioned this, I think, in terms of, oh, actually, sorry, it might have been you as well, Pauline, a bit more equity around vaccines as we think around COVID. But, you know, in different countries, it's not just about access to vaccines. Specific countries, you know, who've been exposed to having kind of lots of, you know, some areas that have their fair amount of fake medicines, you know, I'm not going to believe those things. And if I've been disproportionately affected by COVID, I'm not going to believe I even need it. So it needs a bit more of a focused, country-specific, group-specific approach.
Now, just two quick points from my side. I think, I mean, we had the situation where we actually, where the government or politics tried to pressure those who are not vaccinated in order to get vaccinated. How did they pressure them? They decided to call for a lockdown for those who are not vaccinated. Did it work? No, it didn't work. It is that kind of stigmatizing that actually led to protests on the streets. That's why they changed strategy. But the more you change strategy, the more you lose trust. Doesn't mean that you have to keep on making the same mistake again. If you happen to make a mistake, well, then correct it. But still, I think what is important is continuity in the communication if you want to have a certain level of credibility and trust. And the second point I wanted to make, because there was a question on how local communities actually deal with this issue. Almost a year ago, in March 2021, we had a situation, I'm sure in the UK it was probably similar, on the European continent, where we started to get news and data about a new COVID variant being imported, as they say, from South Africa. And this variant actually popped up also in one of the local communities in the mountainsides in the west of Austria, because they argued that there were people who were on vacation in South Africa and brought it back home. I don't know if that's true, but that was the story. Now, what happened at that point in time? At that point in time, there was not enough of vaccines available, and so this community actually was started to become a testing area. Austria received from the joint European procurement 100,000 additional doses of vaccines to get this local entity vaccines in a couple of days only. Now, this region, this district, there we have around 100,000 people, and the 100,000 people were vaccinated, 80% of those 100,000 people were vaccinated in 5 or 6 days to get this variant under control in this area. And how did this actually, how was that possible? And that was possible because the mayor and other people went from door to door to get people informed and get people vaccinated, basically. Called them by the phone, neighbor by neighbor, and get them vaccinated. And that was quite an effort. But it was also interesting because in this district, we have about, apart from the native, so to speak, we have about we have more than 20 minorities living there, and that was of course the difficulty. In 5 to 6 days, they reach about 80% of the people. But how do you reach this additional 20%? And that's why they started to get the message across in all the languages which were available to reach those people. And I think that was quite an exercise there. It was a success story, which we can probably learn from and have takeaways and understand many, many elements of what needs to be done for successful communication. Although it was a limited district in a limited area, it has many, many elements of success or failure, which we see in on a country level or on a regional level, you name it. So I think we have to learn from those experiences and just make it better.
Thanks so much. So we'll actually then got three more questions from the audience. One question is more specific of the area of interest in this panel, which is primarily Europe and particularly Southeast Europe. Basically, one of the points that Megan Palmer is mentioning is about the potential fact that experts tend to be privileged, on average, tend to be more privileged than the average individual in society, and that might create some alienation. So it could be that some people might react to the opinions of people that are seen as privileged. And another question in the same question, which specifically focuses on that particular area of Europe, is that it is true that in parts of Eastern Europe or Southeastern Europe, the state actually didn't particularly was quite tough on individuals. The systems are weaker than other parts of Europe, and individuals might not have the same level of information or might not have received the same sort of level of education, let's put it that way, than elsewhere in Europe. And that could explain, for instance, the fact that Eastern Europeans in Britain particularly tend to be more vaccine hesitant, right? So I think that this kind of a question that it ties up as well with the point that Pauline made before, mentioned that, for instance, Russia and Pakistan in her data exhibit higher level of vaccination hesitancy. Well, it could well be that migrants are just reflecting in their attitudes, are reflecting in their attitudes, the attitudes of the country of origin. So it could well be that there is a cultural effect in this kind of vaccination hesitancy. So that's one question by Megan Palmer. In addition to the experts' alienation question. And then we have other questions, one by Kamen Lai, which is more general. It's about how to increase the scientific literacy in society. Yeah, I'm not sure whether you have specific recipes here. I guess that is quite a question. And he's asking whether we can do anything specifically focused on older generations that perhaps might not be as well-versed in science. And finally, Anthony Balion is actually asking a question on how to counter anti-vaxxers misinformation. Do you have any actually bringing up your experience or whatever? But I wonder whether you have any recipe, expert, whether you would have any recipe to policymakers on how to counter important misinformation going around the world. Perhaps Pauline or any of you, I mean, if anyone would like to be first, feel free, just raise your hand or let me know, mute yourself. So Paul, yeah.
I would just want to say some words about some of the countries in the central or eastern part of Europe. I mean, it is not of course differences between the country. Okay, I mean, in Hungary, for example, or in the Czech Republic, but also in the Baltic states, the vaccination rates are much higher than, for example, in Romania or Bulgaria. Now, Bulgaria is a particular case because you've had a political crisis for the last years, and that reduces credibility in the public sector even more. Romania stands at a rate of vaccination of 41.6% at the mid of February this year. So this is also very, very low. But I think if Romanians or Bulgarians want to travel to other European countries, well, they will need to get tested or need to be vaccinated. So we will see what effects the summer will bring. But on the other hand, I think that we have to talk about measures to increase trust in the public health system, which is very, very low. And it has to do with history, of course. It has to do with the perception that the quality of the public sector is very, very low. These are national elements which play in here, I think. Now, I believe that these country elements, I mean, you have different countries which have similar characteristics, it's all about trust in the public health system, I think, and trust in politics, and the lack of the lack of public space for science, I think. And keep in mind that Romania or Bulgaria have had, since they joined the European Union and also before that already, huge waves of people, in particular the educated people, leaving the country. So migration, as you have mentioned, Juan, in the UK, migration also has quite an impact on the vaccination rate, I would guess. Thank you.
Thanks so much. So perhaps Pauline or Juliana?
Yeah, thanks. Just adding about the vaccine hesitancy in the Eastern Europe, but also for Russia, because Russia in that study that I showed you where hesitancy was low. So I did look into the reasons in the paper, but they were the first country in the world to approve a COVID vaccine. And that was before they'd started phase three trials for the vaccine, and they hadn't had any results published of early. So there was that issue of the approval was premature. In another study, so not COVID related, but looking at childhood vaccination in the UK, there has been lower uptake in the Romanian and the Polish community. So we did some research there. And actually, it's not necessarily what you think. So either the uptake is lower because the vaccination records haven't translated properly, so they are vaccinated, but we just they're not on the record as being vaccinated, or it's a different name for the vaccine. Also in Romania, it's a doctor that will give your baby a vaccine, and they'll give the baby a checkup before the vaccine. Whereas in the UK, it's a nurse who's qualified and trained to do it. But so for some Romanians, they feel uncomfortable with a nurse doing it without a health checkup. And also in the UK, you wait at the GP, or you used to. I don't know what's happening post-pandemic, but you used to wait at a GP, so a general practitioner, with sick people. Whereas in Romania, they have clinics for babies to go get vaccinated with just healthy people. So it's not necessarily that people are worried or don't trust the system. There were also other factors that it's worth thinking about. That's it.
Brilliant. Juliana, do you have any other additions?
Yeah, just the important bit, it just ends with what Pauline was saying, was just the recognition that there will be other factors, and it's a laziness on our part not to look into those. I think in terms of, because one of the questions was, I guess, related to how do we stop the misinformation? Again, a collective effort that does need, it does need the input of our major organisations. And I think you have seen that actually over the last couple of years. You know, whenever you go on different sites, there would be something up there with a COVID message, but that doesn't necessarily stretch to, you know, the more quieter offline types of circulations. And hence then we do all have a reason to kind of be part of that in terms of the information. And it's not, you know, the idea, I think people do tend to miss is hesitancy. You know, even using anti-vax is awful, but it's hesitancy. I'm unsure, I'm not clear, I'm undecided. That's a useful space to be in, because that's a space that I might need a bit more information. And it's not because I'd be really conscious, it's not because of some intellectual deficit. It's just that the information might not make sense to me at this time in the way that I need it and in the way that my family might need it. You know, for most, not making a generalisation, but it seems like I am, but, you know, particular genders, particular sexes, if you go shopping, some people don't automatically buy a dress or a nice outfit just the first time they see it. You can go up and down that high street many times. And why would we think that's any different, some ways, to COVID, where actually at the same time, people have been exposed over the last 2 years to just complete death and destruction. So it's not unusual for me to be unsure.
I think there's if I may, sorry.
Yeah, go
Pauline,
ahead.
Sorry. You go first, Pauline.
Well, okay, thank you. So I was going to say, yeah, it's okay to question. Like, it's not bad to question. You want people to question. And actually, it's understandable that they have questions. And think about that high street example as well. It's health and social care workers in the UK. They were one of the first people to get vaccinated, and they weren't in a seriously at-risk group. So some of them aren't early adopters to new technology. So they're not going to want the vaccine straight away. And they want to wait for the research and they want to wait for the science. And when we did our interviews with health and social care workers, some were exposed to COVID patients for a month and they didn't catch it, and they were fine with their PPE, or maybe they weren't fine with the PPE equipment, but they didn't catch COVID. So they're like, well, I keep seeing patients every day who have COVID and I'm not catching it because I'm staying at a distance, I'm washing my hands. Why do I need the vaccine? Or other health and social care workers, well, mostly the health, were working from home or not seeing patients, or so they're like, well, I don't need it now. I'd rather actually that my elderly mother gets a vaccine. I don't need a vaccine. So there's that to think about as well. Sorry, Paul, to interrupt you.
Paul, go ahead.
I just wanted to add, if I may, that the speed by which these vaccines were actually developed and then introduced is of course directly related also, or impacts the persistency on the one hand. On the other hand, it would be interesting to analyze the persistency to get vaccinated in the different phases of this whole corona pandemic, because if we now have Omicron and other variants where the perception of the scientific evidence of the level of protection is actually losing strength. We don't know if the vaccines which we have at the moment do protect us the same way they might have protected us against other variants. If we're not clear on this, the hesitancy will grow, of course. And if the effects of getting this virus are more moderate, well, then of course people will be less likely also to get vaccinated. Or are they just more moderate when you're vaccinated? So this is all getting more and more complex. And I think persistency will actually grow, because who would like to get, I think you won't have 80% of people getting vaccinated if if you don't have, if you have, if the pressure on the health service is lowering on the one hand, and other on the other hand, you don't want to get vaccinated every 6 or 9 months. It's just, it's for many people, this would just be too much. So there are new elements coming in. This discussion is not only about the past, but about the present and the future.
So, so it looks like the discussion is ongoing. I mean, we don't have like you know, absolute answers to all the questions, but I guess that it would be great, I guess, to conclude. We have still like 9 minutes, and perhaps it would be great to move on then to the concluding remarks and get like literally a two minute comment on what would be your take. I mean, and that I know that some effort to sort of synthesize some of the ideas, but what would be your take on what is driving vaccination hesitancy and what are the challenges to overcome? So perhaps we could use the same, follow the same order as at the beginning. So Pauline, over to you.
So I may not answer your question, but in terms of my final comment, I think it's really key to listen and to engage. So we really need to figure out the reasons and those change. But also there's a lot of good work going on, and there's a lot of, yeah, people out there in the field vaccinating and knowing what the issues are and having that, that discussion and reassuring people and giving them the information they need. And there is definitely more information out there now than there was a year ago. But it's true that what does the future hold? And in terms of vaccine effectiveness, different variants, in the UK, we're being told the pandemic's over, or currently, but that might change again. Let's see what happens. But this will all impact on vaccine hesitancy as well. And if you've got friends that have had COVID, they didn't get it so badly, or you've had COVID and you didn't get it so badly, you're going to be less likely to want to vaccinate again, potentially. So we still need to watch this space, and it's such an important space. And in the meantime, we just need to make sure we don't stigmatize anyone and work together. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Gianna.
I just think in terms of having a more systemic approach to considering issues around vaccines, vaccine uptake and hesitancy, to understand in a bit more of a sort of geopolitical way that events that happen nationally, internationally, on your doorstep, and not divorced from people's decision making, but also not to throw the baby out with the bathwater. There has been lots of people that have engaged in vaccines and continue to, but this should be a wake up call to not just take, you know, people are becoming much more keen to show when they're not happy with things. And if that has direct implications for their health and safety, and particularly in relation to children, and particularly in relation to countries with not great, with less resources, then we all have a responsibility to try and address that.
Brilliant. Thanks so much. So, Paul, over to you.
Yes. I agree that that all of our countries have a responsibility, a global responsibility. It's nice to hear, of course, from politics that the crisis is over, but is it really? I think it is only over if we can actually make sure that all the people on the whole planet have the opportunity to get vaccinated. I think that's crucial. Two more points on some of the questions that were raised in the chat. I think scientific literacy is key, but we have a lot of translation work to do. And maybe youth and the younger generation could play a big role there, in particular in the schools and beyond. If you look at the climate issue and the Friday for Future movement, you see how this climate issue actually moved from the younger generation to the whole families and then to the whole society. And I think there, if you have a more scientific focus in the classroom, it will and could pay off. This holds true also for another point that was raised on the responsibility of the tech platforms. The more literacy, the more digital literacy you have, the better it is, I believe. And tech platforms have the responsibility. I think much more will be done against disinformation. There we all have to cooperate, I believe. But tech platforms are also an opportunity to reach out to communities which we are not able to reach. But I think we need much more resources to do that. Overall, I would say that I think what we need is sensibility, information, and more trust into science and a communication which is less political but more fact-based. That would be my takeaways.
Thank you so much. So hopefully with all these contributions and all these points that we've heard in the last hour and a half, you can make your mind on the important features that are being currently challenging vaccination uptake and are creating a vaccination hesitancy in the population. Vaccination doesn't seem to be a technical matter that only affects, let's say, health policy making, but it seems to have far-reaching consequences, broader implications. It's linked to populism, climate change, politics more generally. It can be addressed by challenging problems of misinformation and literacy. And of course, we've heard as well about the importance of inequalities, particularly inequalities related to ethnicity and the fact that some communities are being left behind and they use vaccination as a way to get back to on their governments. So I'm afraid that we have to draw the seminar to a close, but not without thanking the presenters and of course the organizers and very few ways to do that using Zoom. And I am afraid I don't have any emoji to basically reflect how happy we are with the seminar, but I hope we keep in touch and recording of the seminar will be available sometime soon for those of you who would like to go back and revisit some of the arguments or those of you who couldn't make it today. Thank you so much and hopefully we'll catch up soon. Bye. See you.